Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast. I'm your host, Angela Pugh. Today, we have a really great guest. I'm excited to have this conversation. My dear friend, Stephen Watts, is with us tonight. And Stephen is a person that has been a great friend and mentor to me throughout my career, these last several years for sure. And he is also a person that has worked in the treatment industry for many, many years. I'll let him talk a little bit more about that, but he really is a walking piece of history with the treatment industry. And it's fascinating to hear. We're going to talk about some of the things that have been in the headlines recently and just talk about treatment in general and how it's changed and what's going on. So welcome my guest, Stephen Watts.
Hey, Angela, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for doing this with
me. You bet.
So I know we were talking a lot about this piece that came out on rehab last week tonight with John Oliver. It's been quite a topic of conversation amongst professionals for sure. And I would love to get your thoughts. He talked about a lot of things. He talked about patient brokering. He talked about a lot of the troubles in Florida. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of those troubles are migrating over to California, and we're hearing similar stories over there. He talked about the UA sort of scandal in treatment centers, overcharging, overbilling for UAs. I think they referred to it as liquid gold. Urine is
right.
Now liquid gold.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about what your thoughts were when you watched it.
You know, there's been several critics that have gone public lately of just the treatment industry as a whole. And one of them, a person who I really, really respect, Dr. Doug Thiemann. It was last year Dr. Thiemann spoke at a conference here in South Florida about the treatment industry and some of the problems, the issues. In fact, he began the keynote by saying the treatment industry was in really just the public was probably at the lowest opinion ever of treatment. And I saw the John Oliver piece, and I've heard some other treatment folks within the industry criticize the industry, and rightfully so, Angela, because And John Oliver mentions this, patient brokering, and I don't know if our listeners understand what that means. Patient brokering is when a treatment center would pay a fee to someone for bringing an admission in, like they would pay an interventionist or they'd pay some other person, although I will tell you I don't know of any interventionists that have accepted a fee for bringing patients in, but I know it exists. I know what happens. So that's kind of what patient brokering, and that is a huge no-no, and just it's illegal, unethical. There's just...
Well, and let's touch on that for 1 second, because what happens then is you aren't sending people to the places that are the best fit for them to get treatment. What happens then is everybody is just doing it for the money and people are ending up in places that aren't the right level of care or the right type of care, and nobody's getting cared for properly.
That excellent. I mean, I could not say it better myself. And that's what happens when unscrupulous treatment centers are when people engage in patient brokering, the fit for the patient or the patient, the actual patient care, what the patient needs is sadly lost out. And so that's the real, real bad part of it. Wherever there's an opportunity to make money in business, there's, as we all know, there's a couple of kinds of business people. There are those that do it by the book. They're honest, they're ethical, they run a very honest business. And then sadly, there are those that don't. You know, the thing about the treatment industry that really offends the public, at least in my opinion, is that we're dealing with human lives here. We're not selling stock or cars or real estate. Treatment programs are charged with the responsibility of human caring. And while we have some really excellent treatment programs in the United States, and I think Dr. Thiemann mentioned in his latest comments on the treatment industry is that we have over 14,000, and you may know this more than I, how many treatment centers we have. We have tens of thousands of treatment centers now, public and private.
I think it is right. It's right around 14,000 right now.
That sounds about right. And that is phenomenal. I mean, if I look back on just, say, back to the 1980s, when we first saw treatment corporations coming into being to open treatment centers and hospitals or freestanding treatment centers for profit, oh my gosh, probably, I have no idea, probably in the mid-80s, 1985, maybe there was 600, 800, 900 treatment programs in the United States. And now we've got thousands. So it's a big industry. It's grown a lot. And sadly, it's attracted criminals, the wrong kind of people.
It is a big, big money business. Though.
It is a huge money business. And there's real subtle nuances to some of the bad stuff that's happening in treatment. And Oliver, you know, he touched on some of it, but you and I were having, I think it was earlier today, we were touching on this in a conversation. I've seen treatment grow, and I've seen treatment develop, and I've seen huge, you know, healthcare corporations that have a string of treatment centers from one coast to the other. And there's really nothing wrong with that as long as patient care is a top consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, that for a lot of treatment centers, that kind of got lost out, and I understand how it happened, because to run a treatment program, to meet the expenses of a treatment program, and a residential treatment program that has medical detox included and or several levels of care, residential, partial hospitalization, and intensive outpatient program, is expensive.
It's very expensive.
Treatment center staffs are professionals, and they require a professional salary. Plus, there's all the environment of care stuff that has got to be paid for. There's a medical staff that's involved. And so treatment it's not a cheap proposition. It's not something you can throw together and throw up. And, you know, the very buildings that treatment are housed in have to meet certain regulations and have to have all kinds of codes met and safety things in place, which is rightfully so, which should happen.
And
so
inspections, certifications,
et cetera.
And,
on it goes. Certifications, state mental health department has to come look at it, and there has to be things like certificate of needs met, et cetera. And this is all good. Treatment is more regulated than people would think, starting with clinical staffs, people that hold a counseling license or a medical license or a licensed psychologist. They are held accountable by what's known in most states as a behavioral health-related board. Treatment facilities themselves, as we just mentioned, they have to meet in certain regulations. So there is oversight there. However, even with oversight, even with state and local regulations, bad things can happen in treatment. Things like we mentioned earlier, like patient brokering. So, yeah, I mean, I get it. And I'm certainly listening to the critics of treatment. And we have got to stop this kind of stuff and clean this part of the treatment industry up. However, I am a huge believer that treatment works, that treatment is good, and that treatment will come out of this. Treatment will go on. Treatment will survive and thrive and will come out of this, I believe, the better.
Yeah.
Because of the scrutiny that the public is placing upon treatment. Treatment is a mystery to most members of the public.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you deal with this all the time. You deal with families, and you're helping people go to treatment, and the families come to you and they say, well, Angela, we don't know anything about it. We don't even know where to start looking. Blah, blah, blah. And that's why people come to you. And we need more people like you out there that has a really good knowledge of what's available in treatment in the United States. A friend of mine a couple of years ago sent one of her children to treatment in Thailand. I
had a client in treatment in Thailand last year, yeah.
Okay. And that was new to me. I said, Thailand, really? And it was a good friend of mine. She said, yeah, it was excellent treatment. And it was, I think the price of the whole treatment program, I think he stayed like 60 days, was $14,000 American dollars. Now that's...
And it's luxury.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what she said. It was luxury accommodations, very nice treatment program. I mean, the environment of care was very nice, and that the she met the clinical director, met staff, and there were some Americans on the staff, some U.S. citizens on the staff, but she said it was a very professional staff. So, you know, treatment is spreading around the world now.
Yeah.
There's certainly illegalities that happen in treatment and have been happening, and Mr. Oliver pointed it out. Dr. Tiemens has talked about it. Other folks have talked about it. I think Dr. Phil's even talked about it. But
my business partner has been on the Dr. Phil show a couple of times, actually.
Okay. Well, just to say that he is a huge proponent of treatment, but he has alluded several times on the show to there's some shady treatment out there. And I think that's a good way to put it. There's just some shady treatment out there.
I think in some ways, I certainly agree. I think that all of the attention it's getting right now for the shadiness will cause certainly those of us that are doing really good work will cause us just to continue to be even more transparent, right? Like my practice in every way is very transparent. I'm very direct with the people I work with. They know what I'm doing, why I'm doing it. I talk about my decision-making process, what I'm thinking about, what I'm looking at, what questions I ask. You know, I'm very transparent. And I think those of us in the industry that are doing good work will kind of start to float to the top.
That is well put, and I think that is great. The cream will rise to the top. You know, what you remind me of, and years ago we used to hear this term, truth in advertising. Treatment programs have websites, and treatment programs advertise, you know, some of them nationally, a lot of them nationally now. And when families are trying to pick out treatment and they have no idea what they're looking at, they don't know what this feature means or that feature means, or this treatment program has a trauma-informed track, or this treatment program has, you know, horseback trails or whatever, it's confusing. I think if I could educate the public, if I could say anything to educate the public about treatment, is I would say consult with somebody that knows treatment.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot. And if you look at a website, and I had a person tell me, I guess it was a couple of months ago, that they were looking at a website of a treatment program, and this woman said to me, you know, I know this is a treatment program, but if I didn't know any better, it looked kind of like a resort vacation ranch kind of thing. And I didn't know, and it had a list of all these different services they offered. I know what counseling is. I know what therapy is. Other than that, they completely lost me.
Right.
That, you know, I mean, patient brokering is at one extreme of the bad stuff happening in treatment, illegal stuff happening in treatment. But there's also some more subtle things like treatment programs offering or telling people, the families or people that are inquiring about their treatment program, we have this, this, and this. And when the client shows up, it turns out they only have this or that.
Right.
So I hope that one of the things that comes out of this, as you said a while ago, that hopefully the good programs will rise to the top, is that treatment programs, all treatment programs, will become very transparent about what they offer, what the client, the admitting new client, can expect when they walk through the doors of that treatment program.
Yeah, I think people don't really know what to expect, and they, especially if you're the family member of, right, and you're looking for treatment, you're trying to figure out where to send your person, you have no idea what it's about.
Right.
And I think us as the addicted person, we probably have a little better idea. Certainly if we have done some outpatient or intensive outpatient before, we know what to expect, probably a little more than the family does, but it gets really confusing. And one of the things we were talking about too on that John Oliver video was that he paid special attention to equine therapy.
Right.
And so you and I have had this conversation throughout the day. And I think, I don't know enough about equine therapy. And I think that's the problem. I don't think it's a problem to do equine therapy. I think the problem is that the general public is not educated enough as to what equine therapy is. What does it mean? What does it do? How does it work? Why does it work?
Yes.
You know, and is it an evidence-based treatment,
right,
as treatment centers love to throw that term around?
Right.
You know, is it in fact an evidence-based treatment, and why? And where's the evidence, and what does it say?
Mm-hmm.
Like we don't educate people enough as to what they should be looking for or what is effective.
I think you're spot on about that, Angela, because things like equine assisted or, you know, treatment programs will advertise. We have a trauma program, or we have a chronic pain program, or we have a professionals program. But to the unknowing public, when they read the phrase on a website, this treatment program is trauma informed. Well, that's great. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
You know, what does that mean to me? And so we've got to do a better job. Treatment has to do a better job of breaking that kind of information down to the public. The families that I've worked with over the years, probably 5% of the families I worked with had some kind of grasp of what was going to happen in treatment. The other 95% were clueless. They don't get a policy and procedure manual when they start becoming parents, that one day their kid's going to become an addict.
Right.
They don't know. And so the public is at the mercy of the treatment industry as far as education about what's going to happen in treatment.
And I think part of that issue is websites tend to speak in professional jargon.
They do.
Rather than speaking to who's actually reading it.
They do. They have, and most websites have a bunch of cool pictures of the treatment facility, which is good. You always want to know, you know, where you're going, what it looks like, et cetera. But that level of explanation of, we have a trauma-informed program because what we have found is that unresolved trauma, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, has a deep, deep correlation and relationship to alcohol addiction, all kinds of addiction.
And trauma, I think, is one of the most misunderstood things. I feel like people have this view of what trauma is, and it's all of these really horrific, sort of violent things, you know, whether it's combat or sexual assault, some kind of violence, always violence, you know?
Right.
And I feel like people do not understand that there are so many traumas that are really everyday life events, and everybody internalizes trauma differently, right? So something that happens to me may be a huge deal and very traumatic for me. If the same thing happened to you, it might not bother you at all, because we're all wired differently and we internalize differently. But I wish people had a better understanding that, you know, sports injuries can be trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Car accidents are trauma.
Absolutely.
The death of somebody close to you is trauma. Natural disasters are trauma. You know, I've lost two homes to fire, one in my very young life and one in my adult life. Like, that's trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are all these things that we kind of experience just living life that cause that trauma, and trauma is accumulative.
Mm-hmm.
It accumulates one on top of the other.
Right.
So that's a piece that I wish we could educate more on.
Oh, absolutely. Because again, you know, the public is not, I don't think most of the public is aware of the different kinds of trauma. I mean, like you said earlier, some people get it that sexual abuse is a trauma, or being in combat is a trauma, or being in a head-on collision is a trauma, or being robbed at gunpoint is traumatic.
Right.
But there are, Dr. Mark Epstein writes a book, authors a book, I believe the title is Everyday Trauma. I think that's the title. It's a brilliant book about what you're talking about, just the everyday kinds of things. Now, he comes at it from a psychotherapeutic plus mindfulness approach, and that's kind of his bailiwick. But the treatment industry can do a better job of explaining to the consumer, the public, the families, the individuals that reach out and call the treatment programs, of what they do, what they offer.
And what is the value in it?
Right.
Like, I feel like that's what I'm always trying to do with people, certainly people who are paying me. I'm giving them value. You know, they're not coming to me because I don't have value. So
mm-hmm.
I always want to tell them, what is the value for them? It's mm-hmm. all about what they are getting, or what I can provide them, how I can help them. That's another place I feel like it's switched, where a lot of websites, especially, and it's hard to convey. I have a lot of websites, and it's hard to convey your message appropriately in the way that you want to. It's really hard.
It is.
It's one of the reasons I wanted to do a podcast, because I want people to be able to hear the thought process and hear who I am and what I'm about, right?
Sure.
Because you can't convey that on a website.
That's a great point. Mr. Oliver talks about South Florida. And you mentioned this earlier in our conversation about how some of the corruption in treatment has spread to other parts of the country, and it certainly has. South Florida has been an area of the country that's received some of the most criticism because it's had some really sketchy stuff happened in treatment.
Right. And it's had the biggest headlines.
Right.
And we're sitting in Palm Beach right now, by the way, recording this podcast.
Yeah, we're in West Palm Beach. You know, somebody told me one time last year, I think it was last year, a couple of years ago, I was here. Somebody told me, we were talking about this very thing, like, you know, South Florida's reputation is really suffered because of some of the criminal kinds of things that have happened in treatment here. South Florida's not the only place. And South Florida has some outstanding treatment programs. Consequently, they are suffering some barriers because of the overall reputation of South Florida. I really believe in the state of Florida, oh my gosh, has taken some incredible trend-setting, groundbreaking steps to prevent this. They've passed some laws here about patient brokering and other things. So the state of Florida, my hat's off to them, they have jumped on this. They've really taken the ball and run with it to at least try to prevent this kind of thing from really getting even bigger or more out of hand. A lot of the really bad, what do you say, bad treatment programs in South Florida, some of them have closed.
Sure.
Many of them have closed. Some of the sober livings that, you know, and you're an expert on sober living. You deal with sober living. You have sober livings. And sober living is a wonderful thing, you know. And the good sober livings, I think, are going to rise just like treatment.
Yeah.
And, you know, the good sober livings that have structure, that have management, that have accountability, that will drug test if there's suspicion of use by an individual in sober living, but mandating, you know, you will attend these support groups or those support groups or these therapy groups or whatever as part of your residence here at our sober living. We're going to see, we've got some of that now, a lot more of that now. Sober living is one of those things that sober living looks simple. I'll go buy a house. I'll put people in it that are coming out of rehab and I'll charge them rent. And boy, I'm going to make some money. That's going to be great. Hey, after all, I've been in recovery myself for 7.5 months.
Right.
And I can do this.
I mean, listen, in theory, it sounds so simple.
It does. It just like intervention, the same way. You know, it's, oh, this doesn't look that hard. I'll read a book or two. And so my point is, and like those are just two of the segments of the treatment industry, so to speak. Some honest people with good intentions have opened sober living or become interventionists. They just didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
And sober living has been, and Oliver, I think Oliver points this out, that has been a segment of the treatment industry that has had new regulations. So that, things like that, and I think even though there's still some shady sober livings in this country, for sure, my point is we've got, this industry has got to regulate itself.
Yeah.
It's helpful when the John Olivers of the world point this out. It's certainly helpful when somebody inside of treatment that knows treatment, like Dr. Doug Thiemann, points it out. But the treatment, it's incumbent upon the treatment industry to clean up our own act.
Amen to that.
That's where, I mean, that's the easiest way for us to do it. Hopefully that's the easiest way for us to do it. In the state of Florida have told some people, you're not going to operate like that. We're going to arrest you. We're going to prosecute you, which is great. And it may come down to that in some other states. California is really getting tough on that kind of thing. So, yes, there are some critics of our treatment industry, rightfully so, as I said at the top of this. We need it. But I like the way you put it a while ago. We are going to benefit from this. There are some treatment centers that need to close. There just are. But there just are. And some of those are treatment centers that people would not suspect. They are treatment centers that maybe have the intention of providing good treatment, but as I said, and we agreed earlier, treatment's expensive. And to provide good treatment, you've got to be willing as a company, treatment company or entity, to have the money to put into a quality treatment program.
Right.
It's not something you can do on the cheap, or rather do a good job of on the cheap.
It is so expensive. I mean, just like you said, staff alone, it is. I mean, you said it perfectly. It requires a professional staff, and that requires professional salaries.
Yep.
So treatment is expensive. There's no way around that. I think, too, people used to look at intervention, treatment, and sober living as these very separate sort of entities, mm-hmm. where really it's a continuum of care. Mm-hmm. You know, really those things all go together. Those are the steps, you know? Yeah. And I've often thought that perhaps a piece of the intervention business having a plateau, we'll call it, these last couple of years.
I like that.
We've had a plateau in the intervention world.
Before that, it was a crescendo.
It was a crescendo. Yes, it was. So I think this plateau, I wonder if people are just feeling disenchanted, thinking that they're going to do an intervention and their person's going to go to treatment and live happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
And as we definitely know, that usually is not the case.
Yeah, yeah.
It usually is not a one and done situation.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of professionals that aren't as committed to the process as would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it requires a lot of attention, but I would say the same thing with sober living. You know, in theory, it sounds really simple. You're going to get a house, you're going to put furniture into it, and you're going to put some people in there.
Right.
And you're going to charge rent and everybody's going to live happily.
Exactly.
And it just doesn't work that way.
It doesn't.
You know, you're talking about addicted people. We have the attention span of a gnat. We are sort of, by nature, very lazy. We are shortcut type of people. You know, we want, what do we say in AA? The easier, softer way. That's what we're always looking for.
Right.
So you want to take a group of those people and put them in a house and expect them to do anything is somewhat miraculous. You know,
that's a good point. You're right.
Yeah. And it, I mean, it's funny because I have these conversations with my house leaders at my houses, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm really trying to step back some and let my house leaders lead and really take care of those houses and become more self-sufficient.
Right.
Because I have some great house leaders that can really do it, you know, and I want them to be empowered to do that and make those decisions and do it well. But it, you have to make your point.
Right.
So I say, obviously, in sober living, we say you don't do your chores, you get fined.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting at community group. Our community group is Sunday nights, and that's our house meeting, right? And we just talk about house business. Did everybody do their chores? Did they go to their meetings? Did they go to IOP? Whatever. And they're talking about getting fined for not doing chores. And they'll start at like $5 or something, right? Which I think is absurd. In fact, it's so absurd that we've actually had people come in on Sunday and just hand the house leader $5 because he didn't do his chore all week. So just like he's paying to not do it, you know? So I went ahead and made the point that just so you guys know, I have been known to make that fine $100. So you can either take the responsibility and you can do it properly and do it well and be a grown up and make a good decision, or you can pay an exorbitant fine. Same thing with the treatment industry. You can do it well and do it properly and do it like a grown up and be responsible and make good choices, or you can end up on John Oliver.
Yeah, you certainly can. You, I want to go back. You mentioned the word community, and we talked about this earlier at dinner tonight about one of your purposes, one of your major goals for Kansas City Recovery's Sober Livings is to build community. And you know, I'm still in this business after all these years. Really, I guess this is kind of a little bit of a selfish reason. I help people go to treatment because the way I see it is the next sober person is going to be a stronger member of the community I live in.
Yeah.
Or the community known as the United States of America, whatever you want to call it. And addiction is such, in my experience, is such an isolating phenomenon. It alienates the person from themselves, number one, and it certainly alienates them from their immediate community, their families, their extended community, their families and friends, or extended family, their work community. All just addiction is a community buster.
Yeah.
And so if people can understand, or if the public or whoever that we're dealing with here can understand that treatment, all phases of treatment, from going into treatment, if the person has to go into medically supervised detox treatment, then residential, then outpatient, and then they go out. You know, what I see the most success in today, and we haven't touched about the heroin epidemic, the opiate epidemic, and that's really a pet peeve of mine because I know it's a serious epidemic, but we have an addiction epidemic period in the United States right now. But what the thing that I really hope that people can understand about treatment is that a big thrust and goal of treatment is to rebuild communities, or is to rebuild the person that they can participate as a communal member of society. Nobody is living in a very few people are living in a vacuum in this country. We depend on each other in families and in friendships and other relationships. We depend on our coworkers. So much of what we do as a human being on this planet depends on community. And I heard you say earlier tonight, we were talking about, you know, what the kinds of things that happen in sober living, your sober living, and in Kansas City Recovery sober living that build community. And I thought, well, yeah, that's what this is about. That's what treatment's about. That's what the whole healing recovery process is about, is to bring people to a point where they can participate as a functioning member of community. And that's what I like about treatment. That's what I like about what I do. You see it a lot. You told me about a young man today that went to sober living in up north for a year, and then he came to your place for a year. 2 years later, he is a highly functioning person. He's able to hold a job, hold a driver's license, hold a conversation with his family. Right. And this, I mean, I never get tired of seeing that happen. In the 45 plus years I've been in the street, I never tire of that. So I get a little bit annoyed by the critics of treatment, and I don't mind the criticism of treatment, but I get annoyed by those who criticize treatment that have never worked in treatment, that have never really been around treatment, that really never know that much about treatment.
Right.
And it's no laughing matter that some really wrong things have been going on in American treatment. I get it. I want it straightened out as much as the next person, certainly as much as the law. But we have the tools to do it. I think that people are waking up. I hope that the next time I hear Dr. Thiemann speak at a conference, maybe later this year or next year or whatever, that part of his message is, you know what, we've had a lot of problems in treatment, but we're starting to turn the corner, because we, the treatment industry, is educating the public, and we, the treatment industry, are strong enough to reconcile the public to treatment.
And what a great opportunity as an industry, what a great opportunity for us just to really get it together and do a better job.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like the money started rolling in, which obviously attracted a different type of person, bringing in a different type of person to the table in the treatment industry. Like, I remember even in the short, almost 10 years I've been in the business, like, I even remember at the beginning of my career when this was really a passion-based business. Mm-hmm. The people that I came across in every walk of this industry, it was a passion. There was a personal connection.
Right.
And we've lost some of that, right? Because it's a multi-billion dollar industry now.
Right.
So there's VCs and angels and, you know, it has changed. But I think this is such a beautiful opportunity where we sit right now in all this criticism, in all the headlines that are not only Florida, but they are hitting California.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of ugliness, but what an incredible time to be able to really clean it up and hold ourselves to a higher standard and really show people that we do still care and we do want to care for their children.
I'm thinking of the word dialectic while you're talking. It's, you know, we have a huge dialectic in the treatment industry right now, meaning that the thesis or the idea of treatment was to provide good quality treatment. And then we've had some of this really shady treatment and bad treatment and unscrupulous people involved in treatment. And those together, we have this mode of treatment, as you know, called dialectical behavior therapy, where therapists are teaching people to work out of their rational minds rather than their emotional minds. And they're teaching them to be able to sit with discomfort and sit with some of the bad things that are happening in their life and just observe them more in a more detached way and not an emotional way. And I apply that to the treatment industry. You know, we have had all this bad stuff happen, but there is still a real good intention, I think, in the treatment industry to provide good treatment. There isn't a huge segment of it. So I believe that the coupling of those two, I hope, will produce a synthesis of a better treatment industry, a better quality of treatment. I don't have any problem. You know, it took us up till just a few years ago to educate the public that treatment costs money.
Yeah, right.
In the 1970s, I guess late 70s, early 80s, I would be talking on the phone. I'd be at wherever treatment program I was working. I'd be talking on the phone to a family about their loved one coming to treatment. Many times it would come to a financial discussion because, I mean, that's the responsible thing to do. And the family member would say, well, how much is there a charge for this? And I'd say, yes, sir, we're in a medical surgical hospital, one of their units, and you know, which, I mean, yes, it's going to cost you money just like if you were coming in to get your appendix out, you
right,
know?
Right.
And so it took, I mean, I've seen the evolution of that, thank God, that people, in fact, to the point that people are going, oh my gosh, how much is this going to cost? So there's nothing wrong with the treatment industry making money, or if it's not for profit, not making money, breaking even, whatever you do. Of course, the old joke about, what do they call an excess of money at a not-for-profit after all the expenses are paid? They call it profit.
Right,
so
right.
There's nothing wrong with this money thing. Greed, like in so many other businesses, entered the picture, and that's where some treatment programs went south. It's simply greed.
I think we do have to remember, too, though, that out of 14,000 treatment centers, the number that we're hearing about is really very, very small. I think there is still a greater number of good that's being done. Those just aren't the people getting the headlines.
You're the first person I've heard in recent months say that. And I agree with you 100%. There are more good than bad. It's like anything else, Angela, as you know. It's like a few bad kids will lead some people to say, well, these young people today, they're just awful. They're not.
Right,
you
right.
Know? And a few bad treatment centers, I know there's been more than a few. There's been plenty of them. But I believe in treatment strongly, and I believe that there are more good treatment programs. I believe that treatment has really kind of eclipsed growth more so than other kinds of businesses and industries in our country. My first formal treatment job started in 1977. I'd been a street counselor 3 years prior to that for a public treatment program. Then I went to work for, it was a small for-profit treatment program in Memphis. And when I look at that and I look how far we have come, there's so many things that have happened. We know so much more about alcoholism, about drug dependency. We know so much more about the brain because of research done at places like University of Texas by some of the psychopharmacologists, Dr. Carlton Erickson, and some of these folks. And the types of treatment, the modes of therapy, so to speak.
Equine therapy.
Dolphin-assisted therapy.
That's where I'm going.
But seriously, treatment has evolved and continues to do so. I believe that treatment is going to clean itself up. I want to say that. I know that's a big statement, but I believe that we're going to get back on track and head in the right direction. I think there's, as you just mentioned, there are a lot of treatment programs whose intention every day is to treat the client first. That's their number one intention, is what are the needs of the client.
So how do we tell people how to find those treatment centers? Like really, when you're looking at websites, I think about this all the time. As a general consumer with little knowledge, I will also say the consumer now and the family that's visiting me now is a much more savvy person because we have Google, right? People do know more now than they've ever known before. Mm-hmm. I think about this all the time. Like, how do we really tell people what to look for and what should steer them a different direction? Are there indicators? Are there things that you could see on a website where you would go, oh, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right?
Yeah, that is.
Because I feel like they all look and sound the same.
Many of them do, and that is a huge question. You know, I was thinking while I was trying to think of, what is the answer to that question you're asking? We don't need more, and I'm not picking on interventionists, but we don't need more, or maybe I am. I have a lot of friends that are interventionists. And we don't need more interventionists. What we need is treatment consultants. I mean, like, we need people, a lot of people across this country that families can call, you're one of them.
Yeah.
Because you stay on top of what's going on in treatment. Families have to talk to somebody that has been in the treatment field and that really knows the treatment field and can steer them and guide them. There are people, sadly, in the treatment field, and I know them, I'm not going to call any names because they'll sue me, but there are professionals in the treatment field that really don't know that much about the national scene of treatment.
Right.
You know, what's really, I run into this sometimes, I'll hear somebody down a treatment program, you know, well, that treatment program is blah, blah, blah. And I can tell just by listening to them, and I finally, when I heard that one time, I asked the person saying, I said, have you visited that treatment program? No, but so-and-so told me. And, you know, I have a friend that did interventions years ago, and the first thing they did when they went into the intervention business is they visited over 100 treatment programs in the United States. They just walked through them. And they called up, and they asked if they could tour, and they did it. So that's exceptional. But families have got to talk to somebody that knows treatment. A website doesn't really do a treatment program justice. Even fancy websites and beautiful treatment centers and whatever, it doesn't do justice to the core issue. What's going on in this building? More and more, the chemically dependent person is shopping for their own treatment. That is phenomenal.
Yes.
You know, more and more we're seeing people say, yeah, you know what? It's time for me to go to treatment, and I got to get out of here and shop.
Now, another thing I want to say about this, too, because we are such a society of reviews, and I think it's challenging.
Yeah, I just caught that. Yeah, we are.
You know, because everybody writes reviews, right, and they're everywhere.
Right.
And so this is another thing I hear from families all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, typically I will spend a few hours collecting information about the person,
mm-hmm,
and then I will choose 3, maybe 4 treatment centers that I think would be a good fit,
right,
for that person.
Right.
I have the families look at those websites, and then I have the families call those treatment centers.
That's a great process.
I have a list of questions that I give them to ask the treatment centers with
awesome
explanations why we ask these questions and what it means. And I do that for a couple of reasons. I want the families to call because I want them to start getting comfortable communicating with the treatment center,
right,
and getting through some of those communication barriers, because
right,
people do speak in lingo and jargon and things like that that the consumer doesn't get.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to start breaking down some of those barriers and getting them comfortable. Also, it's their education. They're learning about it and how it works. But what I get now is, well, I looked at this one and I thought it was really great, and I called them and they sounded great and they answered all my questions, and man, that admissions person was awesome and called me right back, told me everything I wanted to know. But I saw this one review and somebody said the food was really bad. That's what I hear. So I want to be really honest about that too, that you can't believe every review, good or bad, right? Everybody, to a certain point, that's subjective. Your experience at a treatment center is going to be subjective.
Right.
I have plenty of people, I use the same treatment centers over and over again, and I will have 25 people go through one place and have the greatest experience of their life, and I'll have the one person that'll be angry about something, who knows what, and of course, that's always the person that takes the time to leave a review. Does that mean that treatment center is bad? Absolutely not. So I want to be really clear on that too. Obviously, if a treatment center has a lot of bad reviews, I would pay attention to that.
Right.
But you have to remember that we're dealing with people not in their best mind space, not in the best time in their life.
Exactly.
And you just can't believe everything that you read.
Right. Yeah, that's you bring up something that practically nobody realizes or knows, is that reviews of treatment centers are usually written by those who have used the treatment center. And depending on the experience they had, it's going to be how the review goes usually. It's hard for somebody in the disease of addiction at the get-go of recovery or somewhere along there to be super objective. And that brings up for me a larger issue. Who can evaluate properly what good treatment is?
Right.
You know, there are things like CARF. I can't remember what this late at night. I can't remember what CARF stands for. But they're regulating, you know, bodies like CARF and JCHO. And there are things like that which are great. You know, thank God for them. But for somebody just day to day, sit down and start, okay, I got to find a treatment center for my son. Where do I start? And if they don't have an Angela Pugh at their disposal or somebody that knows, it's really, really tough. And families, God love them, sometimes will go, well, we just want Johnny to go to a treatment program close by where we can visit him. And I have started saying, I say this to family members, and I say it with love and respect. I say, do not visit Johnny for the first 30 days of treatment. You are part of the problem. After you go to Al-Anon and the family intensive, I lovingly say,
lovingly,
stay
you are part of
the hell
problem.
Away from Johnny in treatment.
For everyone's sake.
Yeah. Give him 90 days of breathing room. And, you know, but families, again, you know, they're at the mercy of, I mean, picking something out like as important as treatment with not a lot of understanding of what it is that they're picking out. I understand why people write
bad
reviews.
Well, and they're in such an emotional place, too.
Exactly.
There's no way to be objective
exactly.
when you're in the midst of that process
exactly.
and it's your child or your spouse or your parent
right.
or your sibling. There's just no way to be
right.
objective.
Right. Absolutely right. There's usually when families start looking for treatment, as you know, they're in a crisis.
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt.
And they're scared to death of making a mistake.
Yep.
They're scared to death of choosing the wrong place.
Excellent point. They are. They're afraid of that. You know, this is, oh my God, my loved one's life depends on this decision. And so we need some clearinghouse kinds of things to educate people. But we don't have near enough in this country, Angela. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, we have 14,500 treatment programs that are out there every day, hopefully treating people for addictions. And there's not a lot known. So that's what families have to do. They have to talk to people. They can't just look at websites. They've got to make calls. I certainly don't blame the treatment industry for that. That's not their fault that people don't know more about it. Treatment is a consumer good. And like anything else, if you go buy a car or you go buy a refrigerator or whatever, a major purchase, if you're smart, you're going to do a little intel. You're going to check it out. You're going to find out about it.
But it's our responsibility to teach them.
Well, yes,
that's
it is.
That's our responsibility.
Yeah, I agree
I mean,
with
the
you.
Consumer has a responsibility to do their due diligence, for sure.
Yeah.
Same thing for me in my life. It is my responsibility to find out what I need to know and what I need to do, whatever, my responsibility.
Yeah.
But it is our responsibility as the industry to educate people.
Mm-hmm.
We are the people that have the information. It's our responsibility to give the information.
You're right. And probably because of the late hour, my brain's starting to click out. But, you know, I do, as you know, work for a treatment program. and one of the things, you know, my primary focus is to tell people with an economy of words what we do.
Yeah.
And one of the things we do is help people build a foundation in recovery. The treatment program I work for is not given to a lot of, I'm searching for a word here, a lot of superfluous, frilly stuff. We are committed to helping people get clean and sober and help their families recover and to help them. You know what really works in treatment now is when people go and if they start at the extreme end of the disease, they're sick. They're medically run down. They need medical attention, medically supervised detoxification. They've got medical problems, you know, because of their drinking or their drugging. All that's got to be looked at. At that very extreme, as a starting point, the people that have success, and National Institute of Drug Abuse said this 11 years ago, 90 days is a good start in treatment. Now, does that mean 90 days of residential? Could be 30 days, 60 days residential, 45 days, IOP and sober living. Because I deal with families at this time with children who are involved in using heroin, pain pills, and or drinking, and or benzodiazepams, Xanax, Valium, clonazepam, Alprolix, all those benzos. I've told so many parents and so many family members lately that recovery is And when I say this, they just go, literally had people gasp when I say recovery for somebody under 30 is a minimum 2-year proposal. Minimum. That's starting at that starting point of treatment, detox, all that residential, IOP, going on to sober living. And the purpose of sober living is, and I love this, it's to not rehabilitate for most people. It's to habilitate. Learn life skills.
Yeah.
Learn how to function out here in this world.
Right.
How to fill out a job application.
Well, and it's you know, keeping them engaged in a recovery process.
Exactly.
Not a treatment process any longer,
right,
but a recovery process. I always talk about there is, you know, there's an addicted state of mind and there's a recovery state of mind. And, you know, now treatment is getting very short. Insurance is cutting people off at about 21 days.
Right.
That's where I'm getting them at Sober Living now is about 21 days, sometimes less, sometimes a little more. But you're really getting people, they're still in that addicted state of mind, right? They haven't had enough time to shift to a recovery state of mind. But that's sort of the gap that Sober Living will bridge, is it gets you over the hump, right? Keeps you sober, keeps you engaged in a recovery process, so that your mindset can start to shift to a recovery lifestyle from an addicted lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be surrounded by that, right? Like I can't just go home and isolate and sit by myself and hope my recovery gets stronger.
Right.
It just doesn't work that way. You have to actively participate in your recovery. And that's where sober living, I think, is so key, especially as treatment stays get shorter. That sober living becomes even more important because you have to have that time to stabilize and continue to shift into a recovery lifestyle. So important.
Yeah, it's very, very important. And the only thing I would add to that is that families and people engaged in the treatment process, and I like the way you separated that, you know, treatment and recovery, because you're right, there's the immediate needs of treatment and stabilization and all that, and the person learning life skills and really starting to, their brain starting to wake up and heal and be able to make better decisions and choice. There's that acute end of treatment, but recovery has a long-term vision, has a long-term movement. It is a, well, you know, it is, as we say in the program, it's a lifetime, one day at a time proposition. The thing that I would just say is that people struggle with that. Even the patient struggles with that. They come out like, well, okay, I did that treatment. I should be okay now.
Right, right.
And recovery has a sound to it. It has a sense to it. Even has a smell to it. And you know this well. When you're talking to somebody that has had the treatment experience or 6 months in sober living or 3 months in sober living, you do this every day. You hear the progression of recovery in your guys in sober living.
Without a doubt.
You hear, I mean, where were they a month ago? They could barely tie their shoes.
Here
they are 3 months later, and they're talking sense, and they're talking about, they're making better decisions. They're connecting with people in the house. They're reconnecting with family members. And so
they're having fun, and they're feeling good about themselves again.
All of that. And some of them, many of them, they're feeling good about themselves for the first time ever in their life.
Yeah.
So when I talk to people like you, and I talk to other people that are engaged in the kind of work you're in, I get very hopeful and I get very faithful to the mission, so to speak. We need more people like you out there educating people about treatment.
I think we all need to take that education piece more seriously, just as an industry, as a whole. We have to tell people what we're doing. We have to teach them what we're doing. We have to teach them the value.
Agreed.
In what we're doing. And then we have to step up and really do it and do it well.
Well, you're right. And it's one of the reasons that we're at the point we're at now, because we've done a lousy job of educating people about.
Right.
We know what happens within the walls of treatment. The public does not. And we've got to bridge that gap. And really, every treatment center has got to join in and educate the public. This is what happens in treatment. This is why we put people in treatment. This is why you turn your loved one over to a group of professionals for treatment of the chronic progressive illness of addiction.
So how do we wrap this up, this fantastic conversation? Do you feel like we've changed the world?
Well, I'm about to lose consciousness. I'm kidding. I think you've done a great job of wrapping this and just saying that we treatment, that is the goal of treatment. And I think if John Oliver brings you and I on his show, that we will sit down with him and say, yo, John, you know, you're right. The treatment's done a lousy job of really explaining what they do. Why would people ride around on horses or follow a horse around in a barn with a group of people, which is hilarious. But, you know, the wrap up here and the takeaway here is that people like you and I that have been in treatment, and I think we're both respected in this deal, that we can tell the next person in treatment, we can influence the treatment providers. Look, we've just simply got to do a better job of educating people about what we do. There's a lot of mystery about treatment. But the bad guys have used that to their advantage.
Sure.
And so when it's exposed to the public that something bad has happened in treatment, you know, Acme Treatment Center, wherever that is, then there's a tendency, and I'm not blaming the John Olivers of the world, but there is a tendency to jump. Like, okay, we knew that they were bad,
right,
and now they disproved it, and so blah, 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 blah. You know, I have treated, I don't know how many people I've treated. I don't know how many people I've worked with, thousands. And I would like to think a pretty good percentage of them could say, treatment saved my life, treatment saved my husband's life, treatment saved my daughter's life. You know, treatment
sure.
works.
Yeah.
And I know that people are out there. I run into them in my hometown all the time. And they say, you know, I was flying down here this morning. I was flying from the first leg of my flight was Memphis to Atlanta, and I was sitting there, and the woman two seats over looked at me, and she said, you look familiar. And I was, you know, it was early in the morning, and I was just being funny, and I said, did I put one of your family members in treatment? I was, you know, making a wisecrack and in a good-natured way. And she said, as a matter of fact, you did. It had been an intervention that I'd done on a family member years ago, but we've got to know the critics of treatment, fine, they're there, that's great. I've said this over and over, we deserve some of this criticism. But the other side of that is plenty of people have gone through good treatment in the United States and are alive, well, and sober and today and healthy because of treatment. So that's why I get a little bit intolerant of people taking snippets of the treatment industry or just the treatment industry as a whole, talking about it in a critical way, which is fine, but not really talking about the whole picture.
Right. And also because I think it's important to point out too that just because this is what's in the headlines, I mean, these are headlines, mm-hmm. you're talking about television
right.
shows and
exactly.
comedy and ratings and all of that's fantastic.
Grabbing the public's attention.
But also just because this stuff is happening doesn't mean that all of us as addiction professionals are doing these things.
Thank you.
This is a small number of people
Thank
doing
you.
These things. They are getting caught. It is being handled. But just because it's happening doesn't mean that every single one of us is doing it. And I think that's the important part, too.
Yeah, that part is, and I'm glad you said that, Angela. That part is not talked about, and that part is not said enough. And there again, treatment professionals need to be saying that, like you just said it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this with me. I know we've had a really long day, and it's been a spectacular day, and we've had lots of good conversation as usual, and I appreciate you staying up late to record this with me.
Oh, my pleasure. This was outstanding. This was good. I appreciate you having me. I really do.
Yeah, thank
you. I hope we
you.
Have another conversation.
I'd love to.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.